fools with greenish skin. So close your eyes and you will find that you've arrived in Frightenstein. Perhaps the Count will find a way to make his monster work today. If he solves this monster mania, he can return to Transylvania. So welcome where the sun won't shine, to the castle of Count Frightenstein.
Welcome to Pod Stallions, the podcast of Plaid Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me, as always, is Jason.
Happy Halloweeny, everybody.
And just like Jason mentioned, it's October, and that means that our attention will be to My Little Ponies.
Yes. that's going to be the new theme every episode.
Yeah, we're changing the name of the site to the Brony Hour, and that's it. Actually, I think I could fill a thimble with what I know about My Little Pony. So
luckily, we already have stallions in our name.
That's right. We're horses all grown up.
It shouldn't be too difficult.
So no, what the episode is really about is we're doing a two-parter this month. We're going to talk about our love of monsters and monster movies, and then move right over to monster toys for the second part. And it's just, there's too much for one show. And seeing as Halloween is sort of my Christmas at times, I think this is really appropriate for the show.
Well, I find it interesting every time. I don't know why I should find it that interesting that we have so much in common. But, you know, every time it's something big like this or major, I kind of go, oh, my God, I feel the exact same way about it. And that's, you know, that's what initially got us to become friends in the first place. Yeah. So much stuff that we enjoyed. But like from, you know, Gerry Anderson to a lot of the spy stuff to you know, horror and monster stuff. But underneath all is the holiday of Halloween, you know, overall. It is hands down, by a mile, my favorite holiday, has always been my favorite holiday. For those of you that don't know or have forgotten when I've mentioned it previously, I live in Los Angeles, but I was not born here. I did not grow up here. I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, you know, grew up in the Twin Cities. And, you know, it's a great town to live in. It's a great place to grow up in and be born in. The summers are incredibly muggy and sticky, and there used to be t-shirts when I was a kid with I'd have a big mosquito on the t-shirt, and it would say Minnesota State Bird, because we had so many mosquitoes in the summertime. And then of course the winters are brutal, you know, 15 below with a 20 below wind chill. You got to plug your car in at night to keep the engine warm, kind of thing. Brutal. But there's a time in the Twin Cities that is just perfect, and it's about mid-September to the end of October. And I like to call it like windbreaker weather, where it's just, you can just put on a light sweater and a windbreaker, and it's breezy out, and the leaves are changing, and, you know, it's getting dark, and we, you know, it's just gorgeous. And I associate it with October. And it's, you know, Halloween and all that stuff. So all of this stuff in a blender is perfect synchronicity for me. Like, you know, Halloween, you know, would be coming and the weather was changing and the wind was blowing and it was, you know, when it would get dark earlier or does it get dark earlier or later, whatever it is. And in that blender, you've got monster movies, you've got candy, you've got just great colors, dressing up, you know, costumes, and it's non-denominational. Anyone can celebrate this thing. It is the greatest holiday. It's the greatest time of year, I feel, in America. Now, I talked to British friends of mine, just had dinner with a couple over the weekend. She is British, he's American. She never was bothered by Halloween growing up, never really a big deal in the UK. It's becoming something sort of in the UK, but was never a big deal, and she's looking forward to celebrating a Halloween here in the US now. So I can tell you all about my Halloween experiences as a kid and costumes and all that stuff. We got to get into that.
Oh, absolutely.
But because you're Canadian and you live in Canada, we have a lot in common there as well with the seasons.
Oh, yeah.
We're very, you know, Minnesota being very close to Canada.
Yes. Some places further north. I think you're further north than I am.
Yeah, yeah. So we got loads of stuff in common where that's concerned. So tell me about is Halloween essentially the same thing in Canada, and was it the same thing growing up as it is for us in the U.S.?
Well, I've always, yes, we like Halloween a lot. My wife comes from a much colder place where she said, you know, we always had to put the snowsuit over the costume. And that's a pretty famous Canadian thing. I never had to do that, but I did have to wear sweaters and such.
Wait, you never had to
snowsuit it up? No.
Now wait though. Was most of your Halloween costuming as a kid, you know, Ben Cooper, Collegeville, you know?
Oh, you were totally store bought. Yeah.
Same here.
And not even the. I don't know why. If like my parents just drove me to one store and said we're not going anywhere else, or what the deal was, but I you know, I was knockoffs a lot of the time.
No.
I've gone on the message on the website about it a bunch of times, but I was the bat or the spider in lieu of Spider-Man and Batman. And
now, wait a second. These costumes were not a king's ransom back in the day. So how much could the folks have saved by not going with Batman?
Well, I think a lot of precious time, actually. I'm pretty sure that the dollar wasn't the issue. It was, well, we've already come this far, you know, and that was it. But, you know, I when it came to, like, when Star Wars time, I accepted no imitation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, you know, Halloween is the reason that we're going to be talking monster stuff. Mm. But let's start breaking it down as we do with our loves, like we did with the Gerry Anderson episode. What came first, you know, chicken or the egg? Were you into Halloween, and did you associate that with monstery stuff and scary stuff before you got to monster things and monster movies and shows, or was it the other way around?
Well, it's hard to, like, you know, I've been kind of struggling with this since we talked about it. I think I always really liked monsters. I think they were always really there, but Halloween, of course, you walk around, you get candy. It's pretty cool too.
Yeah.
But I would attribute my earliest love of monsters, like, you know, we're 70s kids, and
yep,
you know, most monster kids you talk to are basically kids out of the 60s, and they picked up issues of Famous Monsters, and or they watched the Shock Theater package. But I didn't have any of that growing up. I didn't see Famous Monsters until I was like 12. I didn't have a horror host locally or anything like that. So the way I got into monsters, my first thing is a Canadian TV show called Hilarious House of Frightenstein.
Oh, yeah.
Which is sort of a laugh-in-style show. It was made in Hamilton, the town I actually took you to.
Oh, yeah.
Where almost all the characters are played by one guy, a guy by the name of Billy Van, who later would go on the Sonny and Cher show. But he was a Canadian talent, and he, you know, he would play the Count.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't play Igor. Igor was played by a very large man, looked like a wrestler, who had a very thick, like, I'm going to say Turkish accent, or, you know, and then he would play other characters like the librarian, the wolfman, and the wolfman was very
wolfman.
Jack Cheney, but he played psychedelic records. He played Jumping Jack Flash a lot, which I found out later, I don't think that the people at Frightenstein had paid a lick of royalties for.
Yeah. This is a show, and a phenomenon that I had never heard of until you started talking about it. And you had sent me some clips, I think, or I'd found some stuff on YouTube. You'll have to post some stuff for the folks that don't know what this is. Now, was this a show? Was it ever, you know, merchandised in any way? Was there stuff that you could get as a kid?
No, and the weird thing is about this show is it was all hosted by Vincent Price.
No.
Because the producers, they filmed like 300 episodes of this thing for syndication. Wow. Well, I don't think it's 300, but it's a big package. But what they did is that Vincent Price opened and closed the show. So they flew him in, and it was like a marathon of one-day shooting.
Okay.
And the rumor I think I read about or saw in it, there's a little documentary out there. There's far bigger fans than me. Is that Price was a total joy to work with. And when the crew was getting tired, he left. And when he came back with a case of beer.
Wow.
And he was just like that kind of a guy. Like, here, fellas, a bunch of some beer.
I just would never picture Vincent Price as a beer drinker.
Well, I think he just was a conscientious man. So the show, when I say there's no merchandise and stuff, I probably tuned into the show in 74, 75. It did get syndicated in the States, but it never stopped running in Canada because of Canadian content laws. Something's made in Canada, you put that on for an hour a day, and you can run the shows people want to watch. So, you know, Frightenstein was on from like 6 to 8 in the morning on several channels when I was a kid. So, like, it was old. Like, it was out of print by the time that I caught on to it. So there wouldn't be any merchandise. I think there may have been a fan club at one time. I'm not 100%, but you know, getting that stuff is near impossible. And I'll let everybody in on something. I at one point was very close to getting the figure license for it, and it kind of just fell apart, which I was very sad about because that was going to be the first action figure I released.
Yeah, but you showed them because you ended up making some very cool, you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, and I'm still going on, and I've got another announcement coming up. But, you know, I just sometimes just you make things to just because you
tell me it's not landing.
It is Ted Shackelford.
Woohoo! Yeah.
But it's one of those things I kind of want one for myself, so that's why I'm bummed. But
the Shack.
Yeah. Yes. The whole thing about Frightenstein was probably my earliest monster memory. Like, that's what I like these things. And then going forward, there was a show called Monster Squad on Saturday morning. So, like, I am not associating these characters with killing people or horror or any bit of violence. They are crime fighters on Monster Squad, which is a show by Stanley Ralph Ross, who worked on the 66 Batman show. And for a weird 60s or 70s kind of Saturday morning show, it's pretty fun. Like, I still can watch it. I don't watch it every day, but it was one of my favorite shows as a kid.
Oh, it was such a great show. And it was I seem to recall it as a Saturday morning thing.
It was.
And yeah, and I remember, you know, this is so nerdy, and it makes you just go, God, I wonder if I was insufferable. I mean, I remember being that kid when I first saw The Love Boat, recognizing
Fred Grandy
from Monster Squad. I mean, is that normal for like a 7-year-old kid to be going, oh, that's the guy that was in Monster Squad? Like, that just seems so, I mean, I still do it to this day.
You know what I caught myself doing as a kid? And this might blow a brain gasket. Do you remember there was live action Archie specials on in the 70s?
No, remember the god-awful attempt in the 80s.
No, in the 70s, they did these 2 1-hour pilots.
Okay.
And I can remember one was like a sitcom, and then the other one was just this weird, I can't even begin to describe it. It was almost like Legends and the Challenge and the Roast.
Okay.
You know, that's sort of like, let's try Archie on television.
Right.
And the one was just a straight sitcom, and the other one was this weird sort of, I'm Archie and I'm trying to find myself thing. But the kid who played Jughead in that showed up on other shows like Happy Days and One Day at a Time. He was Julie's boyfriend for a while.
Okay.
And I used to go, there's Jughead. There's Jughead. So, yeah, I had that same affliction as you do, where you started to pick out people.
Well, I don't remember specifically what came first, you know, chicken or egg sort of thing.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I think Halloween probably came first, and I don't know when I associated it with monster stuff. One of my first, if not my first Halloween costume, I think was Spock. I know it sounds, it sounds totally, total cliche, like, no, come on. Everybody couldn't have had Spock. But I'm telling you, I had a Spock costume. I remember specific, I remember going to Target. And this is another thing about Target. I've mentioned it so many times on the show, and I mention it in Geek Shall Inherit. I kind of have a mini obsession with Target stores. Target started in the Twin Cities. It, you know, came out of Minneapolis. And when I first moved out to LA, I'm going to be jumping all over the place here, so try to keep up because I get a little crazy. But when I first came out to LA in the mid-90s, there was one Target over in North Hollywood, and the building I was living in, there were about four of us, all from the Twin Cities. And like once a month on a Sunday, we'd load up into a car, head over to Target, and it was like, it felt like being home, you know, our stuff. We got so much flack from LA people about Target. Oh, it's like Kmart. How can you go to Target? Give me a break. Well, of course, Target exploded in the past, you know, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere out in LA now. But for you know, Minnesotans, we have this real fond connection to Target stores because they were everywhere in Minnesota, and it was a very local thing. And when you walked through the door to the right by the registers, you know, right after the registers, in each Target was a bakery called McGlynn's Bakery. I think they folded by the early 90s maybe. But McGlynn's was the place that you went to get your birthday cake. You know, they had the big book that you looked through and picked out what cake you wanted and stuff. They also had, you know, bread, you know, fresh bread and donuts and stuff. And if I was good, you know, on the trip or whatever, I might get a toy, you know, on this Target trip. And on the way out, I would get a chocolate donut with sprinkles. Now, this practice went on until I was in my mid-20s.
Nice.
If I was good, I got myself a toy and I got myself a donut.
Oh, but you bought them yourself. Your parents didn't buy them anymore.
Right. But chocolate donut with sprinkles is still my favorite donut. So anyway, so Target, we're all kind of in love with Target. And for me, when I come around the corner, even just the other day when I was in the Target out here in L.A., and suddenly see the Halloween stuff.
Yeah.
I am 7 years old again. And there used to be, I can picture it, just this stack upon stack of Ben Cooper Halloween costumes in boxes, you know, and you'd find the name on the side if you didn't see it on top, you know, what face it was, and then the sizes, of course. And I remember just, you know, for my mom, it was probably like, you know, pick a costume, let's get out of here. For me, it was like, you know, buying a car. Like it was just, you know, had to make sure I had the right one and, you know, the size and was the face okay. So I make a big association with Target and Halloween, and they're really good about just loading up the store with Halloween stuff. Monster-wise, started to make that connection with Halloween, but Monster-wise, I recall it's one of two things. One, there was a program, a local horror program that would run horror movies. I want to say late Friday nights or late Saturday nights. And it was called Horror Incorporated.
Neat. And who was the host?
There wasn't a host. There was narration. And you would go down a hallway, and this always kind of disturbed me. When you went down the hallway, there were busts. I mean, I wish I could find this opening. Maybe it's on YouTube. I got to look for it. But there were busts of people like, you know, Chaney as the Phantom, or, you know, the werewolf, or, you know, Frankenstein's monster or whatever, in bust form and very strange lighting. And you would go down the hallway and you'd hear, "Welcome to Horror Incorporated," or whatever they said, "Tonight's feature," or whatever.
It's actually on YouTube, by the way.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'm going there right after this. Because I literally haven't seen it probably since I was 5 or 6 years old. So I was experiencing some of the black and white monster stuff. Also, in the afternoons, some of the Hammer stuff, the color British Hammer horror stuff would air locally, like on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. The other thing it might have been was we used to make a habit of spending 4 or 5 days in the summer at a place called Breezy Point.
Oh, I think you've discussed Breezy Point before.
Breezy Point Resort. Some of you may recognize that name because there were one or two Nick the Lounge Singer sketches from SNL when Bill Murray was Nick the Lounge Singer. Paul Schaefer would play the piano. Franken and Davis came up with that character. Franken and Davis are from the Twin Cities, and so there were one or two of the sketches where you'd hear Murray say, "Thanks, everybody. It's so great to be back here at Breezy Point, you know, and you know we're going to be here, you know, for the next 2 weeks or whatever." And on a particular night, you know, they this is pre VCR and all that jazz. They would, you know, you could go to the blah blah hall, and there would be a band, and you could do some dancing. You know, as adults, I mean, we were kids, so we didn't really care that much. Also, probably on this same trip, I'll sidetrack here in a second. Something else happened that was very significant. But they would one of the nights they would run either Abbott and Costello, and you know, the Laurel and Hardy, but Abbott and Costello type features, and they did or black and white horror movies, and they did a double feature, which I believe was Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein or something, and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And it was the first time I'd ever seen the creature move. I had only seen photos of the creature. Also on the same trip, or right around the same trip, my brother Jack, you know, went, you know, one of the trips to the market to load up for the hotel or cabin or whatever the hell it was, he came back with issue number 2 of the Marvel Star Wars comic.
Oh yeah, I think that's how you mentioned Breezy Points before.
Oh, did I
in the Star Wars show?
Oh, okay.
I knew that sounded familiar.
We did a Star Wars show?
We did, I think.
Oh, yeah, we did.
4 years
right,
ago.
We did.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was that was the same trip, I believe. So it was all kind of coming together. I do think my monster stuff. And the other thing was my brother Jack. Back to him, he had a big hardcover book. I wish I knew the name of it specifically. If I saw the cover, I would know it. That was a hardcover, you know, kind of a coffee table book about horror movies.
So I probably have it. I have every one of those.
It had a dust jacket, and it was kind of a green hued kind of cover. It might have had Frankenstein's monster on the cover. I don't know.
I'll send you a photo of it after the show. I every time I go to Value Village, I find a new one of those. And it's just that, like, oh God, I got to have this, you know.
There are some shocking. I remember being amazed by this book as a kid because there are some very shocking shots in there. One of them, I think, is I don't remember the film, but this is as if I looked at it yesterday. I swear, there's a shot of a man. You know, it's probably one of those like 10,000 BC kind of flicks, and it's a man with a beard wearing sort of animal skins. And there is a bull in the same shot, and the bull's one of his horns has gone through the man's leg. So it's like an on-set kind of shot where this bull horn is through this man's leg. And I remember looking at it and thinking I shouldn't be looking at this as a kid. But I was somehow drawn to the monster stuff, a lot of the classic stuff, even as a kid. I remember Monster Squad as well. I also remember Groovy Ghoulies.
Yeah, that one I don't remember.
That was being rerun, you know, mid-70s. This is all pre-Star Wars, generally. That was being run on Saturday mornings, and that was a big intro to monsters. And might not be as significant from, you know, how you grew up or Canada, but the monster serials. I just talked about this on Geek Shall Inherit. Something amazing has happened in the U.S. They have re-released not just Yummy Mummy from the 80s, but Fruit Brute from the 70s. Those two monster cereals have been re-released this month for Halloween, and Target has retro packaging as if, you know, you came right out of the store back in 78.
I'm actually hopping the border tomorrow to pick some up.
Awesome.
I have a grand opening on the border, and it's like, oh, thank God. I'll just give you a little bit of my history with that. My favorite cereal as a 5-year-old Brian was Boo Berry. Mm. I just loved Boo Berry. And as an adult, I don't eat sugar as what? A rule. Yeah, believe it or not.
You're missing out.
Well, no, I was a heavy set guy at one time, and I gave up sugar, and I dropped, like, all the weight. Because I was drinking, like, this is getting into deal a meal here, but I was drinking, like, three double-double coffees a day, which is, like, six spoonfuls of sugar. Okay. Then I was switching to Cokes, and, you know, it was just unhealthy. But Boo Berry, the last time I picked up Boo Berry, I brought two boxes home for the kids. It's a two-hour drive home, and it was like, look what I got, a box of Boo Berry.
But you know what's sad? And I know I sound like an old man when I say this, and I know nothing is what it once was. But you know, when I go to eat a White Castle, if I ever do, it tastes the same as it did 30 years ago. And McDonald's generally tastes the same, and you know, Wendy's, whatever. But they changed the monster cereals. Now the crunchy shapes are like little ghosts, and the marshmallow shapes are like bats. It used to be, I don't know if they were like little dots or what they were, but they were just maybe little round things, and then the marshmallows looked like little baby marshmallows. I was obsessed with those cereals. And Freakies. I used to get Freakies all the time, too, before that went away.
Yeah. And, you know, you brought up another good point about Target and the connection, and this was weird. The two places I liked to get Halloween stuff were Woolco and Kresge, because I guess they were kind of lower-end shows or stores. And the thing about Kresge that drives me crazy, and it's like I could taste it right now, was the smell of those. My mom, I was obsessed with Creature from the Black Lagoon as a kid. Mm-hmm. Obsessed. And at one time, you know, they had these chintzy, probably 79, they had these chintzy rubber masks of the creature. And this was my grail. I had to have this.
Uh-huh.
And I saved up my money to buy it, and I was digging through that thing, and it was just the smell of that cheap latex combined with – remember all those Kreskes had a lunch counter?
Yeah.
A Kreskes always smelled like a big burning grill. You know, it had that stank like they were cooking tires on that thing. I don't know what – but like Kreskes – like no wonder they're gone. They stunk. But that's the smell I think of when I think of Halloween costumes is – rubber and God, what is that?
Oh, but no, it's funny that you say that because I can make this not the burning stuff, but there was in the Maplewood Mall, there was a Woolworths, and this is back when Woolworths was a big store. Now there was no kitchen, there was no foodstuffs, you know, there, but it was, I suppose the closest you can get is like, you know, in the US is like a CVS maybe or a Walgreens, but even those weren't as big as this Woolworths. It was huge. And that's where I remember getting a lot of Mego stuff and just toys in general. But at Halloween time, it was that combination of, you know, Ben Cooper and the scent of like, you know, that plastic on the Halloween costumes, which I just love that smell. It's such a turn on. And the rubber, you know, the jigglers. Like the monster stuff. And I had like a Spider-Man one, and I think there was like a werewolf one or something. And they had all this stuff. And they had those, you know, rubber masks too, which I never could figure out as a kid. Like, why would you – all I was thinking of was just, you know, one-stop shopping for the mask and the outfit. Why would you get a rubber mask? And then, of course, there were the – you know, one year I went as Darth Vader. And that Ben Cooper classic Vader costume is the Vader mask, and then the chest – is a picture of Darth Vader with the words Darth Vader.
Yeah, but so, that was government issue. I don't know why. You know, everything had that.
You couldn't. It wasn't his chest plate, you know, with the buttons and lights. It was you know, he wore himself on his outfit. But even with that, I've got a picture. I think I sent you the picture. I think it's on Plaid Stallions. It's on the site somewhere of me in that costume, wearing I think my mom's red cotton gloves because it's so cold, and underneath it, of course, I'm wearing my snowsuit, and it ripped the crotch like immediately. The whole nylon thing just ripped, but it was so damn cold, and you would sweat, and then your sweat, I'm surprised we didn't get pneumonia because you sweat so much in those masks, and it was you were cold on top of it. You know, should have been dead by the time I got home. But I associate that smell, that rubber smell, you know, that rubber mask and Halloween costume and kind of action figure-y smell with that Woolworths in the Maplewood Mall. And also, you know, associating it with Halloween as well for some reason. I think it's because that's where kind of a lot of the Halloween stuff was. Also around this time, you know, I started to discover Famous Monsters magazine.
Okay, you did read Famous Monsters.
Well, I mean, again, it's like, did we really read it? There was never much in the way of meat and potatoes in that magazine.
Well, there was lots of bad puns.
Terrible puns. You know, you could tell the studio just sent him a bunch of pictures and said, there you go, that's all you're getting. And then he just made stuff up. But there was never really much like on set kind of visits and stuff. But, you know, at 7 or 8 years old, I'm not sure I would have a significant issue, a Famous Monsters issue that I think I told you I eventually tracked down a few years ago at Meltdown on Sunset here in Hollywood, of all places. They had some old issues of Starlog and Famous Monsters. And then a few years ago, when I went back to the Twin Cities for a visit, I wrote an article about it on Action Figure Insider.
I read that.
Oh, you did? Where I went back and visited all the like the bookstores and newsstands and stuff that I used to frequent, you know, 20 years ago.
I remember
years.
That, yeah.
And one of the bookstores was called Midway Books on University Avenue. Am I going to get that wrong? And Snelling, I think. Anyway. And I just, again, like these memories, as if I walked in the door today, right there in front of me was a Famous Monsters, and on the cover, it was a Dracula, Celebration of Dracula. Talk about a juxtaposition. On the cover, George Hamilton was about to get bitten by Susan St. James from Love at First Bite. Uh-huh. And right next to him, to the right of the cover, was Frank Langella, as Dracula from the big budget Dracula thing.
I'm not sure who would win in a fight there.
Good question. Probably Susan St. James.
I would think so.
And so I picked that up. I was out with my dad and brother one day and I got that Famous Monsters and I managed to find it. Of all the issues they had, like that one, I'm like, oh my God, I have to get this. So I picked it up. So that was a lot of monster stuff, you know, came out of that. I mean, I don't know when I started to understand, you know, when these things were made or what black and white, you know, meant that was, you know, how many years ago that was.
Yeah, that's where the one thing I can definitely remember is that, do you remember these books? They're orange books. They came out for, I think they were for schools and libraries, but they were by a company called Crestwood.
Okay, no, it's not ringing a bell right
the,
now.
The guy who wrote them was a guy by the name of Ian Thorne, and they were very comprehensive books about, it's called the Crestwood Monsters, Crestwood okay. House Monsters, and they did, you know, they did the Creature from the Black Lagoon, they did Dracula, they did Frankenstein, they did Mad Scientist, It Came from Outer Space, The Deadly Mantis, The Mummy, Godzilla, The Blob. And I took every single one of these out of my public library. In fact, even about 5 years ago, I found that they still had them, and I took them out again.
Wow.
Just for, like, nostalgia. Because the Godzilla one and the Creature one, like, I just kept renewing it. You know?
I don't remember those at all.
And I absorbed – and they really were – like the Wikipedia of the time. They would explain uh-huh. each movie. Uh-huh. They would explain critical reception to the movie back in the day. They would show, like, I'm holding the Creature one right now. I treasure it. You know, they show Rico Browning, you know, in and out of his suit. They explain the 3D. They are why I'm a monster kid. I got obsessed with these. I knew who Lon Chaney was. I knew who Bela Lugosi was. I knew who Boris Karloff was. And oftentimes, I hadn't seen any of their movies.
Oh, wow. Well, that's an interesting observation. I think a lot of the times with this stuff, because you couldn't just go to the video store and rent the thing. You know, we were exposed to so much of this stuff and so many of these monsters and creatures and things before we ever saw the films they were in, because, you know, you just didn't know when it was going to going to run. Two other things are happening around this same time, I think, that are significant, that start piecing it together. One is, you know, you just mentioned, you know, Godzilla, you know, Godzilla movies. That was a big thing as well. Like, you know, there'd be the kung fu, late night kung fu features that the local station would run. There was Horror Incorporated on Friday nights. There, you know, on Saturday afternoons might be Hammer Horror. On Sundays, it was Godzilla. Sometimes it was two movies back to back. But a lot of that Japanese stuff from the 60s, my brother was getting heavily into. I, you know, two older brothers. One was obsessed with Star Trek. So whenever Star Trek was on, you know, I'd sit and watch that with him. And then my other brother, the middle brother, was obsessed with Godzilla movies. And so he, you know, I got this great education watching all this stuff. But the Godzilla stuff, you know, always, you know, I never really, it was kind of like the Batman series as a kid. Like, should I be laughing? Is it serious? You know, we made fun of the tanks with sticks underneath them moving around and stuff. But then there was sort of a darkness to a lot of these that I didn't know quite how to take. I also never quite knew how to take Godzilla, because I always felt bad for him. You know, he'd always kind of, you know, wander off into the sea by himself at the end of the picture. And, you know, he just seemed like he was misunderstood or something. But right around this time, I see for the first time War of the Gargantuas. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
That was a very disturbing movie to me as a kid.
Yeah, because one of them is just eating people.
He'd eat people.
Yeah.
He'd chew them up, and then he'd spit out their clothes.
Well, you know, you were saying that about Godzilla movies. I was always the kid who was like, hey, did you see it last night? What? Oh, they played Godzilla on Monster Island. You didn't watch it? It's like, no, I missed it. I was that kid. So the only time I could catch monster movies for sure, and I just happened to have a friend who said, hey, did you watch last year's, you know, Halloween week on Channel 2? And it's a channel out of Rochester or Buffalo. And I said, no. And he goes, well, you got to catch it this week. It's amazing what they're going to have. Mm. And it was Frankenstein Conquers the World, which is a bit disturbing and weird. And it's one of my favorite Toho movies. In fact, I got it for Christmas a few years ago, and I caught my son watching it on my laptop in his room.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's like, how are you liking that? You know, because it's got some moments in it that are a little strange, like, you know, how to test to see if he's Frankenstein. Well, cut off his arm, see what happens. A little drastic. How about a toe?
Let's start with a fingernail, maybe.
Yeah. But War of the Gargantuas, getting to your point, is actually the sequel to Frankenstein Conquers the World, that the two little monsters, they've cut this out in the AIP release, so don't think you missed something. But those two little creatures are cloned from Frankenstein.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, that's something you learn when you become obsessed with Godzilla in your teens.
Obsessive compulsive, like you. Yeah. Well, this is the other thing that I was getting at, was you've got the War of the Gargantuans. There was another perennial that seemed to run, I swear, once a month, and that was The Blob, the film with Steve McQueen as the lead.
Have you ever seen the Larry Hagman sequel?
Oh, my gosh. It's so funny you say that, because he – oh, there was just a something about my buddy Rich Vulture and this improv guy that would tell stories about dropping acid with Larry Hagman. And one of them had to do with the sequel to The Blob for some reason. No, I have not seen that.
Oh, it is fantastic.
Oh, okay. I'll put that on my Netflix queue. Yeah. But I was kind of amazed by that film as a kid. I didn't understand it. I could not figure out the effects. I could not figure out how they were doing this. And I was really disturbed by the creature, this blob, and how it was getting around. But do you remember when the guy gets infected?
Yeah.
And his arm starts to change and stuff?
Scary as crap, yeah.
I had nightmares about that. That really disturbed me.
That kind of stuff always used to bug me.
And what's starting to happen is like we're having, you know, as you, it sounds like both of us are starting to have this push-me-pull-you relationship with horror, where like we're intrigued by it, but then things are happening in certain pictures that are disturbing, but we still go back for more. It doesn't like turn us off and You know, I think that as kids, you either go further into it or you look away and never go back.
You know, my first horror experience was a movie called Evil of Frankenstein. It was okay. Hammer. I was probably Hammer. Five.
Wasn't that Christopher Lee playing the creature? Or am I
no,
wrong?
That's horror. Or, no,
because he plays the creature.
Curse of Frankenstein.
Curse of Frankenstein.
Evil of Frankenstein is a guy by the name of Kiwi Kingston, but he looks a lot like the Universal
okay.
Frankenstein, because I think Universal distributed it. They allowed to use the flat top and the. So as a kid, I didn't know my Karloffs from my Cushings. So I assumed this was Frankenstein.
Okay.
This is the guy I had action figures of. And it's a pretty weird movie. I like it to this day. Some people consider it lesser in the series, but because it is my absolute first horror movie, I loved it. But the thing is, and never forget this, I watched it on Christmas Day. Like, I don't know if they were all drunk at the station or if they thought, well, nobody's watching anyway, you know, but I watched Evil of Frankenstein on Christmas Day, you know, while my mom cooked turkey and my sister and I sat there open mouthed watching the whole thing. And that was really my first turn on to horror movies. And
that's pretty awesome.
I spent a long time, especially 8, 9, 10, 11, like, you know, I got to get home. The Invisible Ray's on, or, you know, I can remember my parents, King Kong was coming on TV and I so desperately wanted to watch the whole thing. And my parents had company over that day and they were all in the living room and I was having a conniption.
Get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had no power at this, but I just can remember having this freak out, which is probably not healthy.
Probably not. But again, it was a different world. Like, if you didn't catch it when it was going to be on, when were you going to see the damn thing? Ever? You know? I mean, speaking of television, some other things are starting to happen here at the same time, which are interesting. Are you still there?
I am. Yes, of course. Okay. Sorry.
I thought I lost you.
You don't hear me when I nod?
No, I'm sorry. I thought you were asleep. Because you just said something about television that's interesting, and this is where it started to kind of blur for me a little bit, and then it all starts to sort of become clear. A couple other things are happening. One is that, you know, I'm going to the movies more as a kid, you know, actually going to the movie theater, and it's right around this time in the monsters were very big in the 70s. They were big in the 60s. But there was like the resurgence in the late 60s and the 70s. For some reason, monsters were really big. Like, there's something very specific about the fact that, you know, Groovy Ghoulies was airing on, you know, Saturday mornings in the 70s.
Well, I think a lot of the 60s trends got a reprisal in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got the superheroes back again after they kind of flamed out in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. The monsters really flamed out in more the mid 60s. So, you know, they just kind of waited for another generation to get onto them.
But what's interesting is, so you've got, you know, the Groovy Ghoulies, you know, happening, and we're all getting into this stuff. And then there are a lot of films are getting re-released in the 70s at different times. So, you know, again, this is pre-VHS. So if you didn't see it the first time round, you know, in 2 or 3 years, they might put it out again and say, if you missed it the first time. And that was true of Young Frankenstein. The first time I ever saw Young Frankenstein was in the theater. And I think we saw that film 2 or 3 times when it was because it must have been re-released. I didn't see it when it initially came out. I was too young. So, but I remember seeing that, and it was, you know, I'd already seen Gene Wilder in Willy Wonka, and he kind of, even though I thought he was funny, he kind of disturbed me a bit in Willy Wonka.
That's a scary movie.
It's a scary movie, and I think he scared a lot of kids. Well,
made me Gene cry.
Wilder, one of the things that I think is so genius about Gene Wilder, and he talked about this in an interview once, might have been that Actor Studio thing, but it was quiet. But it was a brilliant thing that he said. He never set out to be funny. You know, he made a Charlie Chaplin observation once about the way Chaplin played stuff. how real he played stuff. And the humor came out of the situation. So if you look at a lot of Wilder stuff, yeah, he's very funny and he gets loud and manic, but he's also being truthful. He's not trying to be wacky necessarily. He's being truthful to the situation. And if you look at him in Young Frankenstein, he can be very frightening in that movie with the shouting and the antics and everything else. So that was one of those films that, you know, I laughed at, but it also kind of frightened me. There were things in there that kind of scared me. And I think that is a testament to the authenticity that Wilder and Brooks were going for as well, using a lot of the same sets from the original James Whale, film. So that was going on. The Godzilla stuff and everything in the daytime, I'm coming home in the afternoons, coming home from school. We've already talked about this. Two of the musts coming home from school were Battle of the Planets, followed by Doctor Who, when they used to run it as an episode a day kind of thing. My first, and Doctor Who fell into that weird monster thing too, where Famous Monsters did that classic cover, who is the, like the whole Doctor Who, Tom Baker thing, when that was turning people on in the late 70s and figuring out who he was and what those monsters were. Famous Monsters gave him quite a bit of exposure. So
I remember that cover, yeah.
Battle of the Planets, and then Addams Family, Munsters, back to back. So we're getting monster stuff every day as well. And that was huge, watching those shows. I was obsessed with those shows. Every single day, Monday through Friday. And the same thing, and I'm trying to put this all in the same basket, talking about Halloween, there were certain things that ran Christmas time every year. You had the Charlie Brown Christmas special. You had, Little Drummer Boy, all the Rankin Bass stuff, you know, Rudolph, The Year Without a Santa Claus, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. They ran them all in like a couple of weeks, and they always got big ratings. They were on every single year. I don't know what year it was or when I discovered this, but I had a serious Jones for the Rankin Bass stuff.
I
couldn't figure it out. I knew that it was called animation. I knew that they referred to it that way. When you see the TV listing, you know, animated special, my brain told me animation meant the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner show. That's animation, those cartoons. You know, I don't know how they did it, but I know that that's animation, and I know that, you know, Welcome Back, Kotter is live action. But I don't know what this Rankin Bass stuff is. I could not figure it out. I didn't know. I couldn't... you know, understand what stop motion was, and that it was the same thing as like the Ray Harryhausen stuff that I dug as a kid.
You didn't watch like Davy and Goliath and Adventures of Pinocchio and all that stuff?
I probably did, but I didn't.
We called it puppets when we were kids because we couldn't, you know, that was the best.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell
puppet
shows. There was cloth. You could tell that there was cloth somewhere in there. I couldn't figure out how they got the stuff to move. So I don't know when this was, but whenever it was, my brain just about melted when I'm flipping around one day and I come across Mad Monster Party.
Oh, equally, yeah.
Because the Rankin Bass, they did a theatrical feature called Mad Monster Party. I think it was just about the last, if not the last, thing that Boris Karloff ever did.
It was done in 69, and yeah, Karloff didn't make it to the 70s. I think he may have done. He did some other things. He did Targets with Peter Bogdanovich.
That's right. Great movie, actually.
Yeah, Targets. Excellent and wonderful performance by him. And then I don't know if he didn't need the money, but I think Karloff died making crap in Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Because he just couldn't stop working, and it's probably what kept him alive. He wasn't like a lot of the other, you know, like Lugosi, you know, he had to work to stay alive. He was financially okay. I mean, the guy did The Grinch, you know.
Oh God, yeah.
He just had this sort of like work ethic where it's just, I'm not going to stop working. And
well, so I didn't, when I first saw that, again, my little brain, my, you know, 8-9-year-old brain, whatever it was, told me this was those same people that did Rudolph and, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. This is the same people that did that. This is their Halloween TV special. I didn't know that it was a film that made it to the theaters, and now they're running it on television. I thought it was their Halloween special.
So do you watch it every year now?
I have it on DVD, so I make a point of trying to watch it in October, yeah.
You see, it's a family tradition in this house.
Oh, because that's cool.
As a kid, I missed half of it because I had to go to the dentist. And I'll never forget that the first time I watched it. You know, you just knew that this was the most incredible thing you were ever going to see. You know, I loved Rankin Bass as well, and this was the Halloween Rankin Bass, just like you.
And just a couple years ago, or a year ago, when they made the action figures and they made that Karloff.
Yeah, I got those on my wall here.
I couldn't run to get that Karloff fast enough.
I had those on order for a year, I think.
Oh, it just almost made me cry. It's so beautiful.
My wife despises that movie.
Say that again?
My wife despises that movie. So,
well, we're
driving. Well, you know what? It isn't great. And there's a couple of songs that could go die in a fire. But
Phyllis Diller. Ah, ha, ha.
Yeah, well, her You're Different song. We joke about that. The kids and I, if we're on a car ride and it's October, they will demand that movie.
That's
because
funny.
It bugs the crap out of my wife, and they love it. And it's just, you know, it's one of those things where let's all gang up on Mom and watch this. And, you
that's
know,
kind of brilliant.
Yeah. And
so what I'm trying to say is, you know, I'm discovering now, and granted, a lot of the stuff we're talking about is the decade previously. But I'm understanding that there is a fascination I'm developing for monster stuff, but also there seemed to be a fascination out there within the industry or whatever it was to find the comedy in some of this monster stuff. Groovy Ghoulies, Mad Monster Party, Addams Family,
Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
I think there's a lot of humor in horror.
There is, absolutely.
Absolutely. I think it's the uncomfortable situation. Now, having said that, humor, we can't address humor and horror without addressing horrible humor with things and television specials. And I think to add to the atrocity pile of bad ideas with Legends of the Superheroes and the Star Wars Holiday Special is the Paul Lynde Halloween special.
Now, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I didn't know he was gay.
What?
No, I'm gonna be completely honest with you.
I thought he was funny.
You know, it's funny though. He got buckets and buckets of fan mail from women, housewives and single women that thought he was the hottest thing since sliced bread. That didn't seem to understand that he wasn't into the same things that they were, or maybe he was into the same things.
Ever watched the episodes of the Paul Lynde show where he's a married man?
He's a married man with kids and everything.
The only thing that I will say about that show, other than the complete Twilight Zone-y of, you know, hello dear, you know, is the fact that he's really funny in it.
Oh,
like, his shtick is really, it's still funny.
He's very funny. I mean, he's all of his guest spots, his Hollywood, I don't need to tell you this, his Hollywood Square stuff is legendary. I mean, it is legendary. The stuff, not only how funny he was, but the stuff they got away with is shocking, just how much stuff they got away with in the 70s that people seem to miss. But I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure that I saw that when it aired.
I definitely didn't. I was tucked away in my bed or watching.
I've seen it since, and it is one of the
Holmes
single
Yo-Yo or something.
McMillan and Wife. It is one of the single greatest bits of television. It is that. Have you ever seen the Telly Savalas television special?
I think I have, yes.
You know, this was that time in the 70s where
Variety shows,
or it was the summer doldrums where like series were off the air and it was like, well, we know Paul Lynde is very popular on this show. The numbers go up. He was always on Donnie and Marie. He was like their uncle. He seemed to be on every other episode of Donnie and Marie. You know, it's like, well, let's, you know, what's going on this week? Nothing, bunch of reruns. Let's give him a special. And they seemed to give everyone that had a semi-hit show a television special at some time or another in the 70s. Linda Carter got a couple television specials, and it was this was their time to try on different things, you know, a little bit of comedy here, maybe a song there, but it didn't mean that everybody needed to try everything. And like Telly Savalas, for example, the opening of that show is him singing a song, Who Loves You, Baby? Who Loves You, Baby?
Yeah, it's like everybody had to sing.
Everybody had to sing and try something
else. SCTV was amazing for finding the four or five celebrities who didn't get one of those. I think they gave Gene Shalit one on SCTV, you know, and he's singing and dancing.
Do you remember their bit at the SCTV, the battle of the
PBS stars?
PBS.
Mr. Rogers, yeah, fighting Julia Child. Yeah, I did.
And Carl Sagan, I think, was on there or something.
Genius. But getting back to the variety special.
Yeah.
That Paul Lynde one not only wasted the talents of Paul Lynde, like the guy was funny and obviously a cut up, but like just everybody on there is just not great.
But isn't it that, I mean, how do you, there's got to be a term. I wish there was a way to describe this to make people understand that either don't get it or that are younger than us, how, what the thought process was of putting these casts together. Like when you know, it's just fun going on YouTube and looking at the opening of certain
certain
shows like Marcus Welby or Streets of San Francisco, when they'd say tonight's episode, Monkey Do, Monkey Die. Guest starring William Conrad, Marjo Gortner, Zsa Gabor. You know, like this strange mishmash of faces that would never be in anything together. That's how they did a lot of it. And it was like, you know, if Nancy Walker somehow had a bit of a following as the mom on, you know, Rhoda, you know, that Paul Lynde special, isn't the witch from The Wizard of Oz in a couple of sketches?
I think she's actually in the whole thing.
She's in the whole thing?
Yeah. And
so it's kind of like, well, you know, Wizard of Oz, every time we run it on the network, it does well for us. This will be a little wink, you know, a bit of nostalgia.
And the only thing that why this is remembered at all is because it's got an early appearance of Kiss.
Yeah, which is really bold. I mean, it really, that was a big deal to get them on a network show like that.
That
was 76? It was 76,
Kiss,
right?
And Donnie and Marie, that's right. Donnie and Marie were also in it, which, you know, they often toured together. That was 76, yeah. And honestly, this would be a forgotten thing were it not for Kiss.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm going to go even – I will bet that is Donnie and Marie before they got their own show, because I think they got their own show in 77. So it might have been right before they got their own show. And Paul Lynde, I swear to God, was on every week. He was doing sketches on the Donnie and Marie show. But it is extraordinary. If no one's ever seen it, run to YouTube or buy the thing. It is incredible. Who's all in it? It's Paul Lynde,
Florence Henderson, Billy Barty.
Florence Henderson. What television special didn't she make it to?
Well, you know, when you were going to do that whole thing of with, you know, tonight's episode, I was going to throw Florence Henderson in because she was always used in everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like, you know, the last name on the list might be, you know, the blonde-haired cousin kid. They'd always throw in like some kid like, you know, Rodney Allen Rippey or somebody like
Tim Conway, Witchy Poo was on this. Billy
Witchy Poo.
Yeah. Betty White. And Billy Hayes, Witchy Poo.
Billy Hayes.
Yeah.
Who I think I might be right or slightly wrong in saying was actually not that unattractive without all the makeup.
I think she was also fairly young.
Yeah, she was. She totally was. But she wasn't.
Now she's you know, a bit older. But I think she was.
Now she actually looks like Witchy Poo.
Well, we all will.
It's like that old
eventually. It's like that thing the monarch says. You never, you know, when guys start to look like old ladies, you know. when he's talking about Captain Sunshine.
Well, there's the old Liz Taylor joke too. It's like, remember, girls, we all wanted to look like Liz Taylor. Well, now we do.
I never heard that. But, you know, I also wanted to point out the true monster in this. The writer of the Paul Lynde Halloween special is the Mason Reese puppet himself, Bruce Vilanch. Bruce Vilanch.
Oh, that he does. He is totally Mason Reese as a grown man. But yeah. You know,
even Mason Reese probably doesn't look like Bruce Vilanch now. But
totally sidetrack, but we are kind of talking about TV specials. And you know what a Beatle fanatic I am. Ringo got his own TV special in 1978. And it's narrated by George Harrison. He opens it at a press conference, and it had to be after the Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash, Eric Idle TV special, which is one of the single greatest pimps of all time. And for my money, it's better than Spinal Tap, because he gets it so right and it's so brilliant. Nobody saw it. I mean, that thing, if there were 50 shows on in the top 50 that week, it was number 49. But Harrison makes little inside joke references to the Ruddles. Anyway, that TV special, it's Ringo. Art Carney plays his dad.
Oh, I have seen that on YouTube.
George Harrison narrates it. Carrie Fisher, John Ritter, Vincent Price shows up. God bless him. If there was a TV special, Vincent Price would show up for it.
He was a good soldier.
And someone else, and I forget who else it is specifically, but Art Carney. There's a scene between Ringo and Art Carney. You know, Ringo's playing a different character, getting chewed out by Art Carney, but it's an incredible piece of machinery. And then at one point he gets busted by the cops, and one of the cops is Peter Cullen, who will eventually go on to be Optimus Prime.
Yeah. Why do I know his name? That's weird. I'm not a Transformers guy. I guess because he makes the rounds at shows.
Yeah, and he's – I actually met him at the premiere of the first Transformers movie. Mm-hmm. And I was going to have him leave the voice message on my phone, and I couldn't figure out how to work my phone. So missed that opportunity. Anyway, TV specials, comedy, monsters, etc. The monster serials. And the monster serials also, by the way, had the single best – prizes, which for those
remember.
That are much younger than us, they actually used to give prizes away in cereal boxes. You got a toy inside the box.
I don't think young people are listening to us.
Well, they should be.
Yeah.
Turn off Miley Cyrus and listen to us. They had the greatest prizes, the monster cereal stuff. Just the, whether it was a pencil topper or a little statue or whatever it was, and I was obsessed with all that stuff. What would you say? What became your favorite? Creature from the Black Lagoon is your favorite monster?
Yeah, I'd say Frankenstein was, and there's a bunch of reasons why. Mostly because he kind of reminded me of my dad.
Frankenstein's monster.
Well, not in my house, and all vampires are Draculas. My dad was 6'4". He had an extremely blocky head, and he walked around with a stomp. And he had scars. I can remember being like 4 or 5 playing on the floor in the hall, and my dad just like, boom, 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 boom. And he would just like walk over me. I didn't even think he saw me. I can remember that. And he looked like a giant to me from the floor, And so I just associated Frankenstein with my dad. And it wasn't like, anything. I didn't fear Frankenstein. I didn't fear my dad, And of course, I like him now more because I got to inherit my dad's size, his stomp, and I have a blocky head.
And you've got bolts coming out of your neck.
Yes, I do. I try to keep them down, but
Well, that's an interesting that's sort of an interesting little side note here. Now, with these monsters, and they were, this is a different time, of course. Things that scared people in the 30s wouldn't necessarily scare us today or
right.
Whatever. Who did you, speaking for myself, I'll go first. Mm-hmm. I didn't really, like when I talk about the Blob and I talk about the guy's arm in the Blob or anything that involved mutations on people, their faces or strange things, happening to their bodies and things like that. Godzilla didn't scare me.
No.
The gargantuans, they scared me. Dracula didn't scare me, but Christopher Lee Dracula scared me.
Oh, he was scary. He was a problem.
A lot of these monsters, they just never, I never got, spooked by them or scared by them.
The concept of The Exorcist scared me.
Oh.
In the 70s, all that devil stuff scared me.
Yeah, the now possession. We're talking. Well, let's get to that then. So you're gonna pick the creature from the Black Lagoon as your favorite monster, yeah?
No, Frankenstein. As a kid, yeah, Frankenstein. As a kid, it would have been the creature, and I still love him dearly, you know. But I'd say Frankenstein definitely, because I always had to have the Frankenstein in any set that came out.
I'm probably going to go with Frankenstein myself, and the creature. I've always loved the design of the creature. Frankenstein has become such a cliche. Frankenstein's monster has become such a cliche, and it's just like, you know, it's such an iconic image, but. Creature from the Black Lagoon, I find that design extraordinary still. Like, it's just, it looks as good as it must have when it first
came. Yeah, I hope they never remake it and try to make it look better.
Yeah, just leave it alone. But having said that, I would also put in my favorite, if not my favorite, Godzilla.
Yeah, I have a very soft spot for Godzilla myself.
Yeah,
it broke my brain to see those movies with the little toy tanks and I remember just like, you know, just they were pants-wettingly awesome. Now, and I have a very good buddy of mine, Chris, who listens. And hi, Chris. He collects Godzilla stuff, and we sometimes sit together at toy shows, and I kind of don't know what to do with Godzilla movies now.
How do you mean?
Well. I don't want to watch the plots and, you know, I just basically want to watch the monsters fight and turn it off. It's really weird.
Just a highlight reel.
It's almost like a friend you loved at childhood and still dearly do, but you go out to the bar with him and he's a moron and you don't know what to, like, you have nothing in common anymore. All he wants to talk about is, you know, his
stamp collecting,
or his coin collection, and that jerk at the other desk at his work, how much he hates him, or so. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going way too far into detail. I don't have the same connection to Godzilla movies that I once did, but I still dearly love them, and I love, you know, all that stuff.
I would agree. I think I'm more in love with the concept. Idea and the concept and the look of Godzilla than I am in, you know.
Once we get to the toy segment, it'll really come out. I mean, I still buy Godzilla toys, and I love Godzilla toys.
Again, back to design. One of the single coolest designs, and probably the single coolest monster sound in the history of monsters.
Well, who doesn't know what that is? Yeah.
I mean, it's just so... It's so like, I mean, and it, you know, it doesn't sound like anything else. It is Godzilla coming down the street. You just know that voice. Now, when you mention The Exorcist, that's interesting because for me, we're talking apples and oranges now. When you get into that kind of, I mean, we can talk about the horror movies or horror subjects that scare us the most, and then the ones we have the most affection for. I think we both have a strong love for the Universal stuff. That amazing run that Universal had of, you know, all the monsters. And that's another design. The original werewolf design.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. Still just holds
up. Some of those makeups are really hard to top.
Yeah, absolutely.
For their iconic nature. And you know, one thing, I really love Hammer movies. But yeah. I don't think many of their monster designs ever outclassed what Universal did.
No. Did you ever see, speaking of Hammer... the Quatermass stuff?
Of course, yeah. I love that stuff.
That's another... I mean, I think my introduction to that character would have been the Hammer version of the first story.
500 million years to Earth?
Yeah, I think that was it. And that spooked me. That was very disturbing, I thought.
I like those aliens.
Very weird stuff was kind of going on there. But when you're talking about just pure scares... For me, I mean, when we start talking about something like The Exorcist, that to me is like, I don't even know if I can classify it as horror because it's so disturbing to me. I will watch it, you know, I've owned it on every, you know, Laserdisc and VHS, you name it. I'll watch it once, twice a year. I just think it is one of the greatest motion pictures ever made.
I'm actually not a big fan.
I just think it's brilliant, but it's still... scares the socks off me.
Well, a lot of stuff that scared me too in the 70s was like that, you know, Kingdom of the Spiders, Empire of the Ants, or all that stuff, because I thought that was more plausible, that could really happen.
Oh,
the Swarm. I just by the way watched The Swarm the other day.
Michael Caine.
And what a piece of crap that is.
Irwin Allen, Michael Caine and Irwin Allen teaming up.
Yeah.
And they teamed up again after that. Raise the Titanic. Was it Beyond the Poseidon Adventure or Raise the Titanic?
I don't know.
That Caine did with Irwin Allen. I saw The Swarm in the theater. And I knew who Michael Caine was. I loved Roddy McDowall, and I loved Michael Caine even as a kid. And my brother took me to see The Swarm, and I remember him laughing throughout that. I don't know why he was laughing because it scared me. But you just said something. You said Exorcist. You're talking about Kingdom of the Spiders. The other one that we were talking about once that I mentioned to you used to give me nightmares, and you knew it instantly. Where have all the people gone?
Yeah.
With Peter Graves, when people would get zapped or killed or whatever, and you'd look down at the ground, and if it was a guy working in the local garage working on cars, and he was wearing dungarees, the dungarees were just laying on the ground, and white powder was where his arms and face and feet would be. I would get nightmares for weeks over that, thinking that's how I'm going to die or something is going to happen somewhere.
Well, why were TV movies scary? Like, I remember being scared of a bunch of different, so-called scary TV movies. I guess it was, I don't know. Like,
I think they could really push it, because at that point, I think they were, again, in the 70s, movies were getting so big in the mid and late 70s. The box office was mega, that they were trying to push the envelope a bit to compete with that sort of thing. And the first thing that comes to mind where that's concerned and horror and really scared me was Salem's Lot.
That scared everyone I knew as a kid.
That was brilliantly done. It still holds up well. And the guy that played Nosferatu, and James Mason was in that as well. Wasn't he the man that earned the house?
Yeah, and the guy who played Nosferatu, or Barlow, Kurt Barlow.
I thought it was Reggie...
Reggie, no, the character's name was Kurt Barlow.
Oh, you're right. But Reggie
Nalder.
Yes, and you know who else he was?
No.
He was in that Journey to Babel Star Trek episode. He's one of the Andorians.
Oh, that makes sense. He's kind of an odd... It doesn't look like there's a ton of makeup on him.
No, he's an odd-looking character. He was also in... Hitchcock's remake of his own film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, with Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day. I believe he was one of the baddies in that.
Yeah, he's got a good villain bone structure.
Yeah.
Now, totally. We got off of TV specials before we mentioned Witch's Night Out, which we talked about on the phone before, which somebody brought up on the Facebook page.
This is an animated special, a 30-minute animated special, with a witch as the main character, voiced by Gilda Radner. I swear on the souls of my grandchildren, which I haven't had yet, that I have not seen it since it aired.
Yeah,
I remember the theme song. It only aired once when I was a child, and I watched it, and it was. I remember her voice in it and the theme song, and it's probably on YouTube. You can probably
it is, and the minute I dug it up, I realized it's a Canadian produced show.
Is it Nelvana?
I can't figure out if it's Nelvana. I thought it was an early Nelvana special, but I can't. But it was a sequel. There was a it did air on the Disney Channel in the States too, but it was a Canadian staple. There was one called The Gift of Winter before. This was a sequel. The same characters like Bazooie and it's Dan Aykroyd, Catherine O'Hara, Gilda Radner, and Fiona Reid. And Fiona Reid was the wife on King of Kensington, Canada's greatest sitcom. Look it up.
I didn't know Aykroyd was in it. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, good Canadian boy. It's definitely something I remember. I think I remember being marched into some school library and, watch this as a kid. But... The thing that brought up is, and I want to put this appeal out to any listeners who remember these Halloween specials, because I can't find anything about these. One was a variety show called Boo, like B-O-O, exclamation mark. And yeah. It was basically, and I'm sure it's horrible, but I just need closure. basically like a Paul Lynde Halloween special, but it's hosted by Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and they do skits and songs and that sort of thing. And I remember it. And I remember it closed with Dracula saying, "I have a special message to all of you that don't believe in us." And he just stuck his tongue out, and that was the end of it. And of course, there was just tons of canned laughter.
Classic.
Yeah. And the other one I remember, and I think I'm crazy. And I think that might be. I think it was on Global Television. This might be a Canadian kid thing. There used to be a show called Secret Railroad. And it was about
Secret Railroad. Okay.
And it was about a train, Mr. Conductor, and this kid, and he could go anywhere in space and time in this train. They did a Star Wars episode, you know, very kind of tongue in cheek. But they did an animated special called Tales of the Devil.
Jeez.
And I honestly think it was narrated by Vincent Price. And it was just basically three stories about the devil betraying people. And they would play this every Halloween up until a certain point that probably some parents group just freaked right out. but it was really eerie, and the type of animation that they used, the people almost looked like political caricatures. Hmm. So it's kind of ugly Gerald Scarfe kind of looking animation, which really made it even scarier, you know, like...
yeah, that's disturbing. But you just described Scarfe's... stuff is very disturbing.
And again, this is memory, and it might not be that bad. But I remember those vividly. And if anybody has the information on those, I would be in their debt because I would like to track those down.
Speaking of those, and we should probably wrap this up soon because we've got to save some stuff for part two. That was one of the things that I always had a soft spot for as well. You just said three stories about the devil or whatever it was. I liked those Hammer and Amicus, compilation films.
Yeah, the Amicus, they always called them the portmanteau films.
Where there was like three or four stories, like very much like the Twilight Zone film that was made.
I don't think Hammer did a lot of those. Mostly Amicus's cup of tea. And you know, a lot of people run Amicus and Hammer together because they shared Peter Cushing a lot of the time.
And, well, I think I could be wrong. I know for sure Amicus. Tom Baker, too. Didn't he do a Hammer?
He did Vault of Horror.
Vault of Horror. That's right. I knew you would know that.
Yeah, and he did. They did Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror. The last one I think they did was the Monster Club, where it was getting a little more comedic. But I think Tales from the Crypt and Asylum. I really like Asylum, which is written by Robert Block. It has... Peter Cushing and Barry Morrison in one segment. I believe Herbert Lom is in it.
Wow.
It's a very effective film as well, and there's some really scary parts. And there's a really great documentary on Amicus that I just discovered. It's a little light on clips,
mm-hmm.
and the guy who directed it's a little scary himself.
Okay.
Just the way he's not comfortable in front of a camera. But it's like 4 hours long, and it's such a labor of love. And you will not like. First of all, the thing cost me like $7, and second of all, it was two discs, and you just don't leave there going, "Well, they could have talked more about this," because they just, you know, if you find out in one segment that the actor liked to get hammered. They'll talk about it, you know, like they'll say, "Well, we couldn't do the scenes where the plants are strangling the guy because, you know, after his lunch, he was no good at that. You know, the plants would win," and things like that.
Wow, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'll lend you my copy. But,
you know, speaking of, I should leave this with you as well as we wrap this up. Something I discovered on good old YouTube. God bless YouTube, because while I will still buy DVDs and I will still get, Region 2 stuff from the UK because I have a multi-region player, I used to get stuff because there was no other way for me to see it. Like, I would have to get the Region 2, you know, New Adventures of Captain Scarlet, because how else am I going to see this stuff? Nowadays, people are putting everything up on YouTube. Mark Gatiss, who is one of the League of Gentlemen.
Doctor Who.
A writer on Doctor Who, several episodes. The mastermind with Stephen Moffat of Sherlock. Plays Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock's brother in the series, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch's brother. Brilliant writer, huge, huge horror and sci-fi fan, loves horror stuff. He did a set of 3 1-hour specials for the BBC. You're going to have to do the search on YouTube because I don't know the name of them, but he, in these 3 episodes, he covers American, no, I'm so sorry. You know, I could be getting this wrong. He either has 3 different episodes and covers, you know, like American, British, and something else horror, or I think in the 3 episodes, they're about American horror films, and each one is like a different sort of era. Like the last one brings it up to modern day. The middle one deals with 60s, 70s, 80s kind of stuff. He hits Cronenberg. He hits, Friedkin, you know, you name it. And then the first one, I think it's all American stuff. And the first one is, you know, about, you know, the black and whites and Hammer and stuff like that. They're brilliant. They're brilliantly done. He hosts them. He, narrates them, writes these specials. So just, you know, type in Mark Gatiss horror, whatever, and you'll find these shows. There's 3 episodes. They're an hour each. You'll find them on YouTube. They're really, really great. And he covers a lot of ground and has a lot of fun with it. But clearly done by someone that's a huge fan, you know, like guys like us.
If we had
the gumption and the talent to actually go out and produce a documentary like this.
There's a British series I've been trying to dig up for a while that's basically a parody of the Amicus shows, too. And I got to dig out the name of that. I'm going to be Johnny Useless.
The Steve Coogan one?
Maybe it is Steve Coogan.
Steve Coogan did one called Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible.
That's it. And I cannot find it.
It is. I had it on Region 2. It's hit or miss. Okay. When you get the joke, it's very funny. Like when they do like mostly period type stuff.
Yeah.
One of them is like he's a detective and, you know, with, it's like a Talons of Wang Chiang kind of thing. One of them is very much like an early 70s British thing with flares and big collars and things like that. They're very hit or miss. Some of them work better than others. But unfortunately, the single greatest thing about it, Coogan plays a different character in every episode. If you just want to see it to see the range that Coogan has, it's great. The greatest thing about it is the host. And unfortunately, that's literally about a minute and 10 seconds of each episode. But it's Coogan in a white dinner jacket with a black bow tie, in heavy old man makeup, and you wouldn't have any idea this was Steve Coogan. The voice, the face, it's such a transformation. You'd have no idea that it was him. And he intros and wraps up each episode, and it's hilarious. But that's the best part of the whole show.
Oh, that's too bad. So it's not like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place where it's...
No, Marenghi, that's much better. And Simon Pegg shows up in one of the episodes as well.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's an old comrade of Coogan's.
I actually like that.
But I think that's what it is, Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible. I think that's what it is.
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
Is only the end of part one. We've got lots to discuss, many more subjects that we will get to before the big witching hour.
We're gonna do a late October episode where we're gonna talk about my favorite and something that I'm very fond of is monster toys, Halloween costumes, other forms of merchandise. I'm sure I'll get into my love of Paul Naichi movies and independent international stuff, and I'm sure that we have a lot more to discuss in terms of horror. I could definitely go on for 5 episodes if I wanted to, and you know.
Oh, yeah. We got lots more. We'll make the next one a little bit longer, but we'll wrap this sucker up and, come back very soon.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll be back quicker than ever.
Thanks, everybody.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him. When next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.